Remember, I said that the Bible is written to present, in general, what usually happens. The illustration that I always use to make sure that people understand what I'm talking about is a statement that's made in Proverbs. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he'll not depart from it. Most of the time, that's true. If you train your children, they will follow their training, especially as they get older. Spending a lot of time doing psychological research, I know that many times, even kids who leave the Lord, especially as they start out on their own, tend to return to the way that they were trained by their parents religiously around the age of 35. So in general, the Bible is saying, train your children and they will follow that training. Now, every one of us knows some child, and maybe we can think about ourselves, who was trained by good parents the way that they should have been trained, and they still decided to reject God. The Bible is not a book that tries to lay out all of the exceptions. When you compare a book that tries to do that to the Bible, the books that try to lay out all the exceptions just fail. The most famous example of that, of course, is the IRS code. I pity people who file income taxes for other people, because there are exceptions to exceptions to exceptions, and the IRS code tries to lay out all of those exceptions, and the Bible is so simple. So the Bible presents us with a general view of government. That's not always the case, that governments are what the Bible presents as a general view of government, but I think it's often true that governments are the way the Bible describes them. So let's get a kind of a general picture of civil government. And I like to begin with the idea that it's just a sad fact, maybe it's not such a sad fact, but civil government is political. Seems like there's always two sides, and one side is always trying to get the advantage over the other side. And you may find the first example of a political campaign all the way back in 2 Samuel, the 15th chapter. And this is a record of something that happened during the reign of David. One of his sons, named Absalom, is engaged in kind of, I don't want to say it's the peaceful overthrow of David as king, but he's doing an awful lot to bring attention to himself, as we read this in 2 Samuel 15, verses 1 through 6. Can somebody read that?
I can read that. After this, it happened that Absalom provided himself with chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. Now Absalom would rise early and stand beside the way to the gate. So it was, whenever anyone who had a lawsuit came to the king for a decision, that Absalom would call to him and say, "What city are you from?" And he would say, "Your servant is from such and such a tribe of Israel." Then Absalom would say to him, "Look, your case is good and right, but there is no deputy of the king to hear you." Moreover, Absalom would say, Oh, that I were made judge in the land, and everyone who has any suit or cause would come to me, then I would give him justice. And so it was, whenever anyone came near to bow down to him, that he would put out his hand and take him and kiss him. In this manner, Absalom acted toward all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel.
So Absalom kind of tries to subtly, or maybe not so subtly, undermine King David, his father. And I like the way he says it, verse 4. Absalom said, "Oh, that I were made a judge in the land, that every man who hath a suit or a cause might come to me, and I would do him justice." And it seems to me that that attitude of trying to sway followers so that you assume a more important position, it just seems like that's the way that politics works. And we're watching it today. We watch it all the time. I hate to say it, but it even creeps into the eldership. Remember, Paul warned the Ephesian elders in Acts 20. He said, "Men shall arise seeking to draw away men after them." So there's always this tendency to want to build followers, and what that does is, because it's trying to build followers, it undermines the purpose of government in the first place, to be the agent of God who rewards that which is good and punishes that which is evil. Anybody else ever see that in government? No, I'm not. Don't get me wrong. I'm not necessarily saying that's a bad thing. It's just something that we have to understand about the way that government works. Everybody's always trying to build up their side. Let's look at Matthew 5. Can I get somebody to read Matthew 5, verses 25 and 26?
I've got it, Dean.
Okay.
"Make friends quickly with your opponent at law while you are with him on the way, so that your opponent may not hand you over to the judge, and the judge to the officer, and you be thrown in prison. Truly, I say to you, you will not come out of there until you have paid up the last cent."
Yeah, I laugh about it, and I say, never get in a fight with somebody that has a free attorney. So, I think that's what he's saying here. Sometimes civil authority responds to the person that gets there first. And they don't always listen to both sides, but they tend to listen to whoever gets there first. It's that way in families, too. I mean, my kids, when they were growing up, they knew that the person that gets to explain their case to mom or dad first is usually going to have the advantage. So they would race to see who got to explain their position first. And I suppose that's inevitable. Whoever makes their position first generally has the advantage. And when you think about it, in civil trials, in criminal trials, who always goes first? Prosecution. And to offset that notion that whoever gets to go first has an advantage, the defense always gets to go last. Comments, thoughts? Well, I was looking at Luke 18 this morning a little bit. And we read that this morning, Luke 18 verses 1-8. Remember, that's the story of the unjust judge. But because the woman who has a case keeps coming and coming and coming and coming, the unjust judge finally gives in. And he says, I'll grant her plea just to get her to shut up. He's described as an unjust judge, and she is described as a woman who comes seeking justice. She's not seeking something for her own benefit. She's seeking justice. And even the unjust judge, who has no thought for God or man, even the unjust judge many times will be able to work out justice. So don't be afraid to ask. And then let's look at Acts 24. And let's read verse 10, and then drop down and we'll read verses 26 and 27.
When the governor had nodded for him to speak, Paul responded. At the same time, too, he was hoping that money would be given him by Paul. Therefore, he also used to send for him quite often and converse with him. But after 2 years had passed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus, and wishing to do the Jews a favor, Felix left Paul imprisoned.
So this is a case where Paul's case was not heard fairly. And there's really no question about it. Verse 10, Fadus, my verse 10 reads pretty much like yours. When the governor beckoned him to speak, Paul answered. He said, for as much as I know that thou hast been a judge of many years, or hast been of many years a judge unto this nation, I cheerfully make my defense. So Paul went in thinking he would be heard. And unfortunately, he wasn't. The governor just kept him in prison because he kept looking for a bribe. And that's not the way that it ought to be. But sadly, we have to acknowledge that that's the way the government works sometimes.
Dean?
Yes.
That also was God's plan, though. He put that stumbling block there for the unjustness so that we'd end up in Rome.
That's a good point. God uses even unjust men to accomplish his purpose. And that's a very good point. No less than he used Pharaoh to accomplish his purpose. Now, if I'm in the position of Paul, I'm going to look at that and say, why are you being so obtuse, or why are you not listening to what I'm telling you? Paul has to, every one of us is going to look at our own situation. We're going to plead our case based on our own situation. And like Carol reminds us, always remembering that God may be using us and putting us in an unjust situation so that a much larger purpose can be achieved. Now, if I'm the guy who's in the unjust situation, that's hard. It's always hard. What do you mean? I need to be violated so that God can make a bigger point. You made a very good point, Carol. And I know how hard it was for the Apostle Paul. I know how hard it was for Joseph to be in prison. And he's in prison when he is absolutely innocent. Potiphar's wife tried to seduce him. Joseph winds up going to prison. And you look at that and say, yeah, how many times do you think they're going to believe a slave over the wife of his owner?
Dean?
Yeah.
He must have believed something, because normally you wouldn't be put in prison. Normally you would have been killed for molesting your owner's wife. So there is something there that still shows God's protection there. And the same thing when he's thrown in the pit. Do you think he said, oh, good, I got thrown in the pit instead of being killed? Oh, good, I got sold into slavery instead of being killed. But it's the faith. It's the same sort of faith that Job had, that God brought me into the world. And just rolling with the punches, that whatever comes my way, that God will make it be for the good.
That's a good point. That's an excellent point. It is hard that, you know, Christians are... Oops, something happened there. There I am. Christians are often in the position of acknowledging that God is in control. But in their particular circumstance today, it may not look like it. I watched the video of the Christians in the Ukraine, a video that was made as they were huddled in a basement to escape the bombing. And they say, we believe God will protect us. I hope that I have that kind of faith if it's ever called into question. I've lived a blessed life. I have a lot of problems with our government. I think they make bad decisions. I think that they do this and do that. But the government here has never come beating down my door wanting to know if I was a Christian or not. And I pray that that never happens. And, you know, I go through this and I talk about the general view of government. And I think the way that I interpret this information is even influenced by the fact that I live here. And it's easy for me to say that governments, by and large, are doing what's right. They're doing the things that God intended for them to do. If I lived in a different place, I would probably have a harder time. And it might cause me to understand these passages in a different way. So I think this is really timely. You know, I'm not diminishing the inconvenience and the pain that we go through with all of the mask wearing and can't go out. And then I look at people in Afghanistan and I think, you know, I need to grow up.
Dean?
Yeah.
Lee and I were rewatching Fiddler on the Roof, and you know, it's that same relocation thing that is in that same general area that the Russians were kicking the Jews out, and they were talking about, I guess Russians pronounce it Kiev. So it's still in the same general area of what they were talking about.
Yeah, Americans call it Kiev.
And so there it is. It's been going on since long ago.
You're right. You're right. And let's just thank God that we get to live in a place where we don't have to deal with that. I don't think that's because we're not trying to be Christians. I don't think that that's the case at all. But I am very thankful. Well, it's 6:30. It's just 6:30. I'm thinking bottom of the hour, I have to stop. No, I get to go on. Yay. Other comments? Okay. Our next idea is one that the Apostle Paul presents in 1 Corinthians 6. And I feel like sometimes we don't appreciate everything that there is to appreciate about this idea that's presented here in 1 Corinthians 6. So let's look at that for just a little bit. If you begin in verse 1, Paul asked them this question, and apparently it's because there were some problems among the Corinthians. He says, "Dare any of you, having a matter against his neighbor, go to law before the unrighteous and not before the saints? Know ye not that the saints shall judge the world? And if the world is judged by you, are you unworthy to judge the smallest matters? Know ye not that we shall judge angels? How much more things that pertain to this life? If then you have to judge things pertaining to this life, do you set them to judge who are of no account in the church? I say this to move you to shame. What? Can there not be found among you one wise man who shall be able to decide between his brethren? But brother goes to law with brother, and that before the unbelievers. Nay, already it is altogether a defect in you that you have lawsuits one with another. Why not rather take wrong? Why not rather be defrauded? Nay, but you yourselves do wrong, and you defraud, and that your brethren. So as I read this, it seems to me that Paul is correcting a problem there, and the problem is kind of two-pronged. The first is that there were matters of dispute between brethren. And he says in verse 8, you do wrong and you defraud your brethren. You have given your brother a cause of action against you. And that should never happen. That should never happen. Don't ever give your brother a cause of action against you. Now, sometimes these causes of action arise. And he says, when it does arise, many times the best response is to just take the wrong. So what would he be talking about? Well, maybe I sell something to my brother. And we have a sale that's worked out. It's something that's it's a legitimate sale. I'm going to sell a piece of property or something like that. And my brother buys that piece of property and it's all laid out. And it turns out after he buys the property that there's something wrong with it. I didn't know that there was anything wrong with it. He didn't suspect that there was anything wrong with it. But it turns out there's something wrong with the property. So he says to me, I don't want it anymore. What should I do in that case? Now, I could go to court and I could ask the court for specific performance, and I could say to my Christian brother who bought the property, hey, I'm sorry, you know, we had a contract and it didn't work out to your benefit. That's tough. And I could ask the court to enforce the contract and make him buy the property, even though he doesn't want it. I think another course of action would be for me as the seller of the piece of property to say, you're right, it's not going to work out for you. I'll take the loss. Give it back. I'll give you your earnest money back. And, you know, now you're not going to be whole. You spend some money doing soil testing on the property and all of that. But I'll take the property back. Which of those is the course that you think Paul would tell the Christians to follow? Specific performance administered by the court, forced by the court, or saying, I'll take the property back. I'll take the loss. Ron, I'm sure you encountered that. You've been in real estate for a while.
I have more than once. Most of the time, people entered into a contract and then couldn't come up with the funds that they needed to buy the property. So it creates somewhat of a problem, that's for sure, when you have a legal contract. But most people are understandable. You know, they understand. Although I've had one or two that push the button just a little bit. I've not had anybody to go to court, but we've solved it one way or the other. But it certainly does happen in this business world.
So that, and I think Ron raises even better position, better circumstance than I was talking about. You agreed you were going to buy the property. You thought you had the loans all worked out. You've made a down payment on the property, the earnest money. And then it turns out you can't get the loan. Well, the person that sold you the property is perfectly right in saying the earnest money's mine. But Christians are not going to use the court to enforce their right. They sometimes suffer wrong. That's not to say that civil government and courts are always wrong. I've heard it say Christians should never go to court. But sometimes Christians go to court not because they're trying to get the court to judge something, but because they're simply trying to get the court to administer something. And I think this is really something that we have to think about. You know, when you proceed through a distribution of assets based on a will, a lot of times you have to go, after someone dies, a lot of times you have to go to court and the will has to be what's called probated. And at that point, the courts are not deciding anything. And the worldly judges are not making a determination. They're just saying, okay, we're going to help carry out the will of the person who died. In that case, I don't see that there's any problem going to the court to say, this is what we ought to do. And then there's one other case that I didn't think about until just now. I don't know how I missed this. Remember when the Apostle Paul was arrested and the mob was going to take him, and you kind of get the impression that the mob was going to tear him limb from limb? And Paul said, I appeal to Caesar. That shut down everything. That was Paul's right as a Roman citizen to have his case heard before Caesar. And it brought everything to a close. And that's what triggered Paul being brought to Rome. Now, Paul later makes the statement, if I've done anything worthy of death, I refuse not to die. I should restate that. If I've done anything worthy of death, I don't refuse the death penalty. I will willingly submit to death if I've done something that's worthy of death, but haven't. So Paul relied on the courts to make sure that there was no shortchanging of justice.
Dean?
Yes.
I think that's sort of the point. If you're both Christians and you go to people who use God's word and God's understanding as the judgment for what's to be decided, then it should be as amicable as it possibly can. If you go to the mob normally or to the court, you have the possibility of corruption and evil, that somebody can buy the wrong decision that needs to be done. And so one of the points is, are you going to trust your brethren and the Lord's law, or are you going to trust the law of the land?
Good point, Carol. Good point. So I'm going to have to go back and make some additions to this slide. Now, the next thing that I want to talk about is the idea of national righteousness. This is something that I really struggle to understand. When I read what people write about national righteousness and governments that try to pursue righteousness, most of them make reference to the situation during the theocracy. The theocracy was that period of time in the Old Testament where civil government and religious affairs were handled by the same person. There was no difference between the church or the religious affairs of the day and the civil affairs of the day. And it may be that while in the Old Testament period, God had a plan for the great nation that would come from Abraham, that plan may have been replaced by a much more individually focused plan, and a plan that's not focused on a nation, but now focused on a church. So in the New Testament, it seems to me that the emphasis is the individual and on the church much more than an emphasis being placed on what a nation does. But I can't argue with the point that a lot of people have made that nations are sometimes guilty of sin. And sometimes the government that we're a part of becomes an agent of wickedness. Let's look at Genesis 9. And this, of course, is that when you look at Genesis 9, remember, this is God giving a warning to the nation of Israel because this nation was chosen by God. I can't make the same statement about the United States. I can't say, that the United States was chosen by God, like I can for Israel. Genesis 9, verses 5 and 6. Surely your blood, the blood of your lives, will I require. At the hand of every beast, I will require it. At the hand of man, even at the hand of every man's brother, will I require the life of man. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he man. In other words, there needs to be, as far as God is concerned, capital punishment for murder. Or, at the very least, extreme punishment for murder. Because remember, even in the Old Testament period, when the people came into the land, the Levites were given certain cities, and those cities were cities of refuge. So that if you killed a man, now, it couldn't be murder, but if you killed a man, which could be homicide, you could go to that city of refuge, and that man that you had killed, his relatives, could not put you to death as long as you stayed in the city of refuge. So there was a provision for leniency, even under the Old Testament law. But in general, murder was to be punished with capital punishment. And it must be said, our nation has decided that we're not going to do that. I think it may be that God will hold us accountable for that decision. I'm not saying that I want to be the person who's in the position of determining always whether someone has committed murder, but that determination needs to be made. It needs to be made fairly, without corruption. Numbers 35, starting at verse 29. These things shall be for a statute and an ordinance to you throughout your generations in all your dwellings. Whoso killeth a person, the murderer shall be slain at the mouth of witnesses. One witness shall not testify against any person that he died. Moreover, you shall take no ransom for the life of a murderer that is guilty of death. He shall surely be put to death. So this is not going to happen at the mouth of one witness. But if you have witnesses, multiple witnesses, at the mouth of two or three, then this person is to be put to death. You take no ransom for him that has fled to this city of refuge, that he may come again to dwell in the land until the death of the priest. You shall not pollute the land wherein you are. For blood, it polluteth the land. No expiation can be made for the land for the blood that is shed therein, but the blood of him that shed it. Thou shalt not defile the land which you inhabit, in the midst of which I dwell, for I, Jehovah, dwell in the midst of the children of Israel. This was something that God expected. He expected it because this was his dwelling place. And that's what makes me think that it may be that we need to think about this in terms of not necessarily a nation like the United States, but we may need to think about this in terms of the church, because now God lives in his kingdom. Not necessarily the kingdom of the church. Deuteronomy 17 at verse 12, pretty much a restatement of some of these principles. Deuteronomy 17, Yeah, go ahead.
Before you get to the next point, is my recollection correct that if you testified incorrectly, that the punishment that the other person was supposed to get or got was your punishment also?
I believe that you're right, Carol. I just don't remember where that is. I would have to look for that.
I think the problem with our capital punishment is we have too many people who are convicted on the word of one person and not two people. And that's one of the problems, is that people have been railroaded, and that's not right.
That's true. We have an imperfect justice system. And I would like to say that our justice system always works, that there is no corruption, that people don't get railroaded, that juries listen dispassionately to the information that's presented to them. I know that that's not always the case. Deuteronomy 17 at verse 12, I think is one of those cases or one of those statements that kind of reminds me that the key here is putting the evil away from the nation. The man that doeth presumptuously in not hearkening to the priest that standeth to minister there before Jehovah thy God, or unto the judge, even that man shall die. Thou shalt put away evil from Israel. So evil is put away from the nation. And the nation may have been replaced by the church. That's kind of my understanding of this, that what's paramount in today's world is not the nation, but it's the church. We could talk about that a lot more, but I do think, whether we're talking about the nation or we're talking about the church, that there's something that needs to be said. Proverbs 14 at verse 34. He says, righteousness exalts a nation. Sin is a reproach to any people. I think if given my understanding, I would say righteousness exalts a church. Sin is a reproach to any church. In the Old Testament theocracy, yes, righteousness exalts a nation, sin is a reproach to any people. And it will always be that way. And when we don't do that, when we don't understand the importance of dealing with those that commit sin, we create a certain society. Micah 7, beginning at verse 2. The godly man is perished out of the earth. There's none upright among men. They all lie in wait for blood. They hunt every man his brother with a net. Their hands are upon that which is evil, to do it diligently. The prince asks, the judge is ready for a reward. The great man, he utters the evil desire of his soul, and they weave it together. The best of them is as a briar. The most upright is worse than a thorn hedge. The day of thy watchman, even thy visitation is come. Now shall be their perplexity. Trust ye not in a neighbor, but put ye not confidence in a friend, to keep the doors of thy mouth from her that lieth in thy bosom. The son dishonors the father. The daughter rises up against her mother. The daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemies are the men of his own house. As for me, I will look to Jehovah. I will wait for the God of my salvation. My God will hear me. we have not been righteous in our execution of the laws. We've gotten, like he says here in verse 3, the hands of the evil men, the hands are upon that which is evil to do it diligently. The prince asks, the judge is ready for a reward. The great man utters the evil desire of his soul, and they weave it together. So I think because we've left off the notion of doing what's right, we've created a gross society. And we've decided we're not going to punish the evildoer. And so you get pictures of things like kids running into stores, smashing display cases, and walking out with thousands of dollars worth of merchandise. You get a kid on a bicycle riding into a drugstore with a trash bag, filling up the trash bag and riding out of the drugstore because he knows nobody's going to stop him. Nobody's going to enforce the law. Nobody's going to say, you can't steal. And so it happens, you know, it's, I guess what policemen call it, the broken windows philosophy. If you don't deal with the little crimes, it just gets worse. And this is not a political discussion. It's not a discussion of what the government ought to be doing. It's a discussion about the Christian's view of what the government should be doing. And ultimately, I think it all has to get back to Micah 7 at verse 7. I'm not going to look to government to correct this. I'm going to look to Jehovah. And he will take care of it. And I might add, he'll do it perfectly, with no mistakes. We try to do our best sometimes, and we make awful mistakes. And innocent men have been put to death. I know that. Sometimes we weren't trying to do the best we could do. We put them to death because they were different. And we need to acknowledge that we've done that in the past. That's not what we ought to have done. It's not what we ought to be. But until we learn to trust in Jehovah and not reforming our government, I think we'll be disappointed.